This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not. Oh, David.
We've got a murder. Murder most foul. Two authors, the suburbs and murder.
A mayhem. Well, and of course, one of the favourite reading genres is crime. And one aspect of crime is murder. And I hadn't really thought of all the ways murder can be done until now. Emily Webb has researched and written about true cases in her book Murder in the Suburbs. Welcome, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
Your previous book was Suburban True Crime. So was it your research that led you to these other murders?
Well, I have an interest in true crime. I've had it for a very long time, since I was probably too young to read it, but I read a lot of true crime when I was younger. And I just have a particular interest in suburban crimes. I was a local news reporter for Leader newspapers back in the day, and I loved doing, you know, crime reporting, court reporting, and just, I don't know, something about murders that happen, you know, where we live, because most of us live in urban areas, in the suburbs, and just the all the ways that things can happen. And when you've got a connection to an area, it can be quite shocking. So that's really why I just ended up doing sort of more suburban stuff than not.
You introduced me to a new word, parasite. What's that?
Well, parasite is when someone kills a parent or a close relative. So very sadly and tragically, there are murders that happen where a child or a niece or a nephew per se kills their parents. There's also the killing of their siblings, but I have covered some of those cases in the book. In particular, one that springs to mind is a man in Wollongong called Matthew DeGrucci. He was only about 19 at the time. This was in the 90s, and he murdered his mother and his two siblings brutally. So, yeah.
And even after he was found guilty, the father still couldn't believe the son could do it.
No.
Now, you quote the Australian Institute of Criminology report that killing a parent was the second most frequent domestic homicide. So what's the psychology behind this type of murder?
I guess it's individual for each case, but broadly speaking, of the cases that I've read about, that I've written about, there's several motivations. There can be complex mental health that comes into it. We do hear about that happening, where someone has got really complex mental health and is possibly, probably delusional. There's sometimes like perceived grievances against a family member, like it could be money, it could be anger. I mean, there's also the case of where one of the parents has been abusive to that child, you know, so it's really complicated.
The most frequent murder is intimate partner killings. But these cases often present as missing persons, first off. And you write about, in this type of murder, quite often there are no bodies, perhaps until so much later. We have Linda. Now, she had an interesting group of friends. There was sex bondage and threesomes. Sounds like fun. And these were the friends who helped in the search, even doing letterbox drops to find her. But what else did they know about Linda?
Well, what they knew about Linda was they were the last people to see Linda, and they indeed murdered her. That's a case from Queensland, and it was really sad because it spoke to me of the betrayal of trust. That is what I actually called the chapter. But yeah, Linda was a young woman and who got in with this couple. You know, he was really weird. The guy's name was Sven, and the girlfriend was extremely impressionable, probably very silly. And yeah, it was really sad, but they actually joined in the search for Linda, who went missing. And you do hear that. Often police will be keeping an eye on who's helping in this search here, what's happening here, because sometimes people want to insert themselves in the investigation or the search to throw suspicion off them, or because it's a very sick kind of thrill they get.
Another case had a mother who had adult children. One, a married daughter, dropped in a couple of times a week and knew that her mother was looking forward to being a grandmother. Why would she disappear without a word? Did she really leave a note to say she was going on a holiday?
Well, I really found this interesting. This was in my writing. I never have a plan when I'm writing. I'm really like unstructured. And I just kind of like look at cases. And this one was from 1950 in Victoria. It was actually at the time the biggest search for a missing person ever. And it was a woman called Caroline. She was in her mid-50s. She had adult children. She was a grandmother. She lived in Frankston. And she, yes, just suddenly went missing. And, well, you know, yes. Reading between the lines, you like, I think maybe the husband had something to do with it. But it's quite, there's a lot of twists and turns in that story. Yes. But I love digging through, you know, researching that. And it was really sad. The thing is, I always feel such profound sadness because that person who goes missing, they have no voice, and it's only the people who speak for them, often the perpetrator who's, you know, throwing police off the scent, even his own children. He didn't even tell them the truth.
Another missing woman, her upstairs neighbour was brought in for questioning, and he was absolutely persecuted by the news and then the social media, with the real murderer even contacting the police with new information to further intimidate him. That's a pretty hard one to prove that, you know, you're innocent.
Yeah, that's a more recent case. That was in 2011. That was a young British woman called Joanna Yates, and it was a big story. It was actually her, it was a neighbour who murdered her, but the person who owned the flat, it was like a subdivided house, and she lived there with her boyfriend. And the person who owned those properties, and he lived there as well, you know, he was like eccentric looking, bit odd. He was persecuted by the media. It was a nightmare. He actually ended up getting paid money in compensation, and in his case was brought up in the Leveson inquiry, which was all about the phone tapping and the dirty tricks of the newspapers. But yeah, he basically, all eyes were on him as the suspect, when actually it was the other neighbour that she barely knew. But yeah, he was hounded in the press, called a pervert, you know, his character was completely assassinated. There was a telly mini series made about that. But he, you know, he'd not been charged with anything. And it just shows just, you know, the media is brutal, especially the British tabloids.
Sometimes the police do ask for help, and they bring in those that are grieving for help too. One baby snatching case, 4,000 replies. So it puts a lot more work onto the police too, to assess and follow up and hoax trips. The baby snatching. The grief involved by those parents. Absolutely horrible. Mm. Yeah. And you go back to a 1932 of a baby snatching. That's the Lindbergh. Now, Charles Lindbergh, what did he do? Where was he in the news?
He was like, you know, like royalty in America. I mean, obviously not royal, but he was an aviator. He was an adventurer. He actually was a Nazi sympathizer as well. But, you know, he was like royalty. So he and his wife, they had a little baby, like it was a toddler, and that baby was kidnapped. And that really was a huge story and probably one of the biggest baby kidnappings ever. That's why I mentioned it in the book. And look, it's really sad, but there's a lot of twists and turns in that.
There is.
Oh boy,
it's still stuff being written about it in 2024. But this was a quote: "The press was in a frenzy. Amateur sleuths and psychics clamored to help, as did gangster Al Capone."
Yes, there was many interesting things. They had members of the underworld offering to, you know, find out what was happening. There is like gold involved in this. There is like the man who was convicted. Was a German immigrant called Bruno Hauptmann. Now, there is a lot of speculation as to whether he was a bit of a patsy for that. It's very, I went down a rabbit hole with that, I can tell you.
Which made a very interesting rabbit hole. Sometimes crimes have changed how society works. Now, because of these baby snatchings that you've written about, some of them happened in hospital. So hospitals have put in a much more security so that it can't take place. And even work was thought of as a safe environment, but now companies have put in more work-safe strategies. Can you explain the term going postal?
Wow, yeah. So this, we hear it sort of bandied around. Going postal is used as like you're just losing your proverbial S, basically. You just have had enough. And it actually stems back to a case in America. It was a man called Pat Sherrill who actually worked for his local postal service, the United States Postal Service. It was in Oklahoma. And he went into his post office and he shot many people. And that was, you know, look, we know that these things happen in America, like unbelievably. And he had a grievance. He'd been sacked. He was, you know, like people who were a bit odd or anything, that doesn't mean you're going to do something. But there was a lot of things about Pat that, you know, putting them together, it's like the perfect storm of possibility and the access to guns, but that's where the term comes from.
Well, thankfully in Australia we have work safe strategies, but it doesn't include how to survive a mass shooting event.
Yes.
And not only workplaces, but shopping centres are now not assumed to be safe places. A judge said to a murderer, "Your actions have made every parent feel less safe, less trusting, less worried." Mm. This murder was in Perth. And it had international rumours attached to it.
Yeah, it certainly did. This was just horrendous. A little girl called Sophia in Perth, she, you know, was, I think she was around 9 years old, so she was with her, like, her male relatives, her brother. And, you know, at a certain time, age, you don't go into the, you know, the toilet with your, you know, your child. Like, they can go, and they were right nearby, and she was actually... she was murdered, and
which led Western Australia to bring the first to have a public sex offender register.
Mm.
And sometimes the bodies are never found. The ambiguous loss, and you've got a mate, Susie Ratcliffe, who set up Leave a Light On. Mm. What's that for?
Susie's beautiful. So her older sister, Joanne, actually, Susie had never met Joanne because Susie was born afterwards, but Joanne went missing in Adelaide at Adelaide Oval. It's probably behind the Beaumont children, one of the most famous, you know, abducted missing children cases. She and a little girl who was there, a four-year-old, they disappeared and never been found. And Susie's got a real passion for helping families and friends of missing people. And there is a lot. And there are people who go missing for various reasons. But particularly, you know, certain cases get more attention than others. So Susie really wants to highlight cases where people may not have as much, I'm not saying sympathy, but, you know, there's not as much media traction.
Emily Webb has written about random shootings at a cricket match, poison in chocolates, and the horror of a woman who was obsessed with knives. Thankfully, we can trust doctors and nurses, can't we?
Well, my husband's a nurse and my mother was a nurse. Look,
there's another book you've written.
Oh, yes. This is my true crime interest. I wrote, it's called Angels of Death, and it's doctors and nurses who kill, and it's broadly known as healthcare serial killing. It's rare. It does happen. Very complex, but there are people who use their position and access to murder patients for whatever reason.
Murder in the suburbs. A true crime case is committed by neighbours or even family, with often the psychological reason of why they did it. Researched and written by Emily Webb. Thank you so much, Emily.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, interesting, because my book's also about murder and local murder in the East Melbourne area. It's baby rhyme time for new mothers and their babies at East Melbourne Library. But in Penny Tangi's novel, What Rhymes with Murder, a body is discovered and the mystery of this unfortunate death has to be solved. So, Penny, welcome back to 3CR.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, with any murder mystery, the trope is that the lead investigator is compromised or flawed. So who is our protagonist in this regard and what challenges does she have to face and overcome?
Yeah, so the protagonist is Frida, who is a new mother. She's just had her first baby and she's had a bit of a difficult time with anxiety in particular, and finding it really difficult to leave the house and worrying about things happening to her baby. So when we meet her, Finn, her baby's about 6 months old now, and she started getting treatment. She's starting to feel better and she's starting to leave the house. And so one of her excursions is to go to Baby Rhyme Time at the library, which sounds like a lovely thing to do.
But you've got, you know, my psychiatrist, Fiona, not only gave me medication but also had very helpful suggestions for stair fear. Mum stayed with us and we practiced together with me holding Finn. At first, Mum walked beside me, then a little behind, then further back until I could go all the way down and up while Mum waited at the top. 2 weeks ago, I went out all by myself with Finn for the first time. This is a very real thing for new mothers, and the hypervigilance and hyper-anxiety that she's got to overcome.
Yeah, and I mean, definitely, you know, postnatal depression and anxiety are big issues, and I think we know more about them now and there's less shame about them now, but that doesn't really make it any easier when you're actually in the middle of it. And so it's not... So it's not so much of a flaw in Frieda, but it's definitely something that she has to overcome.
Yeah. I don't necessarily see it as postnatal depression. I don't know whether I'm correct or not.
I think in this case it's more anxiety, but it's definitely postnatal mental health issues, which probably started when she was pregnant as well.
But also it would affect every parent. You're concerned about the welfare of your child. But there's also something else that's happened earlier, which complicates this situation as well.
Yeah, there was probably, she's had difficulties with fertility and having a miscarriage earlier, which has then made her more anxious. That doesn't always happen, but sometimes it does for people.
So it sort of compounds the issue.
Yeah.
And so it's a very real thing where she's basically got to try and leave the house. And it's what every... you know, new parent might be going through. But this is where we get to the murder, because just on leaving the house, she gets to Baby Rhyme Time. He's interrupted by a high-pitched, terrified scream, closely followed by a dull thud. So this innocent practice of going to Baby Rhyme Time, and we have a body over the balcony of the mezzanine floor. Now, there's something quite disarming about what you've done here, babies and murder. What sort of genre are we in here?
So this is cozy mystery or cozy crime. So just listening to Emily tell those real life stories, and I know true crime is like people are fascinated by it, but I nearly cried. It's so sad. And I think that what cozy crime does is it's got the fascination of the murder and the mystery, but it's also we're all having a lovely time. So it's got these elements. They're often set like in a cozy English village or in a bookshop or just somewhere that's, you know, nice. And so it allows people to think about the difficult things in life and those really sad struggles and the complexity of human beings and their behaviour, but in a safe way, in a way that's also, yeah. So I think that's what it does, which you cannot, sometimes I feel guilty about. I'm like, oh, I'm making fun of this very, very serious thing. But yeah, I think I think that's what it is, that people want to think about these things in a way that they can feel safe as well.
But you've counterpointed things like, this is the way we say hello, say hello, say hello, to a corpse on the floor with blood leaking out. And so there's something, yes, terribly charming about that.
Yeah, the babies did need to be very young, I felt.
Yeah, well, this
I don't think you could... If it was a toddler, I think it'd be a problem.
This is something you raise, because what's Frida's concern with Finn, her baby, when Frida sees the body? What's going through her head?
She's like, oh, Finn's going to be traumatised because he can see this. But he doesn't understand. He's actually looking up at the fan that's going round and round. So he's not actually even looking down.
And can babies actually see that far?
Probably not. Like, I think it's okay. I think it's okay. I don't feel guilty.
What have you done to traumatise this child? Yeah. But now we need to get to the body and the group that this person is associated. Who is dead and what is the group involved?
They're called the Family of the Sacred Child, and they're an anti-abortion group who's protesting a clinic in East Melbourne. which is a big part, well, it's not a big part of East Melbourne's history, but a big part of abortion law reform in Australia, and more specifically Victoria, has centred around events in East Melbourne. There's a lot of different things that have happened in East Melbourne that have all kind of led to abortion law reform.
And it seems that Beatrice, who's the person that has been found dead, is a member of this group, it seems, at the outset. But this gets onto a very interesting issue, because you have localised it. There is a family planning clinic in East Melbourne, and you do raise the history of women and suffrage and social activism with women and abortion rights throughout the novel. So there's some actually fascinating things. I mean, to begin with, that issue of abortion is very current and will always remain so, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think I started writing this book probably in 2018, and which was a long time ago now, and probably at that time I probably felt that things were fairly resolved and that this wasn't really, you know, I was more sort of writing about a historical thing and that we'd come. And then, of course, things in America have really kicked off. And I think one of the characters in the book actually says at one point, like, you never just get rights and then you get it forever. You have to fight for it continuously to keep it. And I think that will, you know, that's the case with abortion rights. And I think, I don't sort of want to inflame it either. Like, I don't want it. I don't want people to continue to have to debate this over and over again. But then sometimes I think about it. It's a little bit like raising children in terms of rights for women and rights for everyone and equality. You don't just raise one generation and then that's done. You have to do the next generation. Like, we all have to keep going to make the world that we want to live in.
Well, contemporary history would tell us that that is the case, that it has to be renewed all the time. But you do go back into what's happened in East Melbourne. We've got several characters that emerge. Dr. Christine, who's working at the clinic, her sister Mariana, who's running herstory tours, not history, herstory tours, and there's another sister, Grace, all of whom become suspects at some time. But Mariana's tours, who are some of the characters that she brings to light in these tours?
Well, there's you might be interested in this. Well, you've probably heard of this one, Emily, that Dr. Peacock, who lived on the corner of Wellington Parade and was, well, he says he didn't, but he definitely was performing abortions. And Mary Davis?
Davies, I think.
Davies, yeah. She came to see him and she was never seen again. And he says that she left, but he was charged with her murder and he was convicted, and then he appealed and he got let off. But they searched through that entire building, like pulled up all the floorboards, searched his property in the country, and they didn't ever really find a body. And so I think it's sometimes a case that gets mentioned to law students as a case of, you know, can you be charged for murder if there's no body? Which you can be, but, yeah, it's a lot trickier.
You've got somebody in here called... You've got somebody here called Margaret McLean, which just so happens to be my mother's name, but it's not my mother you're referring to. But in past times, a social activist in this area.
Yes, there was a lot. Yeah, I think they started the Monster Petition, the suffragettes. They were involved in that. There's a lot of,
Ola Cohn, a sculptor, and you can still see her work today.
I love Ola Cohn, yeah. She's got the fairy tree in the Fitzroy Gardens, which is... I saw some photos of it when it was first done, and it has actually changed quite a lot from when she first sculpted it. But also she's got her a house and studio where she used to live, and she's got some of her sculptures in there, which you can just go past and see in East Melbourne. She was a sculptor, I think, in the 1920s, which was it was very male dominated, and she went overseas and studied and then came back and got some really big commissions and, was a very successful artist.
But there's a darker side. Bertram Wainer, you make reference to.
He was quite an amazing man, actually. He was a GP and he felt very passionately about abortion rights, and he thought he had a poster in his office that said every child a wanted child. He really felt that every child that was born should be wanted. And so even though he didn't like the idea of people needing to have abortions, he thought that they should be able to if they needed to. And it was at a funny stage in the history in Victoria where we, for quite a long time, it was just common law that that abortion wasn't illegal because a judge made a ruling that if for the welfare of the mother it was okay to have an abortion, but nobody really knew the limits or the parameters on that. So Bertram Wainer set that by rocking up to the police station and going, I've done an abortion. What are you going to do? Are you going to arrest me? And they didn't arrest him. And then that said to all the other doctors, oh, well, this is legal now. And he did it three times with three different situations, starting off with the mother's life is in danger, moving on to economic circumstances weren't good, moving on to, well, I'm just about to start uni and it doesn't really, this is not a good time for me. And all of those, he was never arrested, and then it became just the common law in Victoria.
So you've painted this fabric in the background of all that's going on that Frieda has become aware of as she's raising her child. But getting back to the murder, what are the benefits of a good murder for Frieda? So we're getting back to the cozy nature of it now.
So she gets out of the house, she meets people. Other people are quite interested in this murder too. She's got something to think about. You know, a lot of research is just looking stuff up online, but then she gets to talk to other people about it, and it's something to think about. Now, I'm not recommending this as a hobby for everyone, but, you know, it works for her.
But you can see the evolution of Frieda's psychological development progression as she's coming out of herself, given the psychological challenges she's had at the beginning.
Yeah, basically, yeah, yeah. It's sort of, she does sort of become more confident and more interested in the world around her.
Well, it's healthy because she ends up having a sort of dream about Constable Seb. So there's another character.
Mm.
But that's healthy. She's married to Ben, but basically the interaction with other people in the community, the police and such like, so much so that, yeah, you're imagining situations or dreaming and it's going beyond just that hyper-anxiety of one particular focus.
Yeah, I think it's about, and when you have a baby, when you've got a really little baby, like they call it the baby bubble, like for the first few weeks or even months, like you really are in a way, I think, biologically programmed to just focus on that baby, and you can be very, very insular. But then at some point you need to sort of come out of that. And so, Frieda is able to sort of start taking an interest in other things and imagining a future as well. Yeah.
So if you're ever worried about traumatising your child or interested in local history or wanting to familiarise yourself with events at your local library, What Rhymes with Murder is the book for you. Do you have a word that rhymes with murder, Jan? Further?
Birder.
And it's a Simon & Schuster release. So, Penny, thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you.
And I was speaking with Emily Webb about her book, Murder in the Suburbs, a Big Sky publishing.
You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.